Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I'd like to begin this episode with a few questions. What is an education for? What does an education do? What is an education? Both Christian and non-Christians discuss, debate, and agonize over these questions. Our future depends on it. Our kids need it. The next generation is formed by it, and our economy relies on it. For the longest time, really until the 20th century, maybe a bit before, formal education was available for the elite few. If you were rich, if your father was well-connected, or if luck or providence was on your side. Education trained the upper crust, clergy, lawyers, doctors, lawmakers, and the like. Informal education, on the other hand, happens for everyone everywhere. It's job specific, it's in families, and it's for the trades. Everyone is educated. It just depends for what. Most of this changed with the rise of the modern university and public school systems. Education is now democratized. It's available for anyone. Majors weren't available until the late 19th century and then proliferated in the 20th century. Schooling meant better jobs, higher paying jobs. More technical jobs require a more technical education. So that began dominating the space. Before any of this, the answer to what is an education for was to produce virtuous citizens who can benefit the society. Education was whole person formative. It helped us become the kind of people who asked the kind of questions that drove society forward and answered the questions of who are we, what do we do, why do we exist, and what do we exist for. In many ways, public education has lost sight of this. More recently, within the past 70 or so years, Christians took it upon themselves to both separate themselves from public education and reestablish the models of old. The most dominant methodology of old was the classical model, practiced for centuries by Christian and non-Christian alike. In fact, there was no other model besides classical. Education wasn't classical, it was just education. What happened then was we took classical methodology and responded to public education. We focused less on forming virtuous citizens that can ask the questions that help propel society forward, and more on a distinctly Christian approach to the society. If public education did or said something, we did or said the opposite of that, attached prayer and some Bible verses, and called it Christian classical education. Secular science was feared. Critically examining texts that were antithetical to the faith was dropped, and training future Christian soldiers became paramount. Because in order to form a more perfect Christian society, you need to train your children what to think, less how to. Be careful, they might think differently than you do. We can't have that. Welcome to episode 8, Indoctrination Stations. Critical thinking is left at the door. We need uniformity. In this episode, you'll hear from Dr. Susan Weisbauer, author of The Well-Trained Mind, multiple volumes on world history, and a leading voice in homeschool and classical education. You'll also hear from Jill Reitz, a trained educator herself, a mom of kids who attended a well-known Association of Christian Classical Schools institution, the Oaks Academy, and a teacher aide at the same school. Dr. Bauer discusses the various approaches to classical education, what homeschooling is, whether or not Christian belongs in the same conversation as classical, pedagogy, which is teaching theory, and more. Jill provides on-the-ground experience as a parent and aide, explaining what it's like at one of these institutions. These aren't institutions of education. They are institutions of indoctrination. Let's begin with Dr. Bauer.
So I'm Susan Weisbauer. I am a writer, historian, and an educator. My primary job is actually writing history. That's my jam. That's what I enjoy doing. I've done a number of world history series for W.W. Norton and for Well-Trained Mind Press. I got involved, however, in homeschooling because I was homeschooled. And I was homeschooled starting back in 1972, when it was not actually legal in Virginia to homeschool. And my mother, who is an educator, did not want to send us to the local public school that she had graduated from because we live in a rural area. She was the only person in her family to graduate from high school and go to college. And she was the only girl in the county to go on to college at that time. Yep. She said when she got to college, she had never even written a paper and she didn't know how to use a library because the local public school didn't have a library.
That sounds like modern kids, too, which is kind of funny.
Yeah. There's definitely some resonances there. So she decided that she was going to educate us herself because she didn't trust anybody else to do it properly. So we were home educated. And when she started home educating us, she wanted to give us what I think now you would probably just call a traditional liberal arts education. So she wrote away to a number of schools that she admired. And these tended to be sort of old school boarding schools in New England and also Jesuit schools because she had a real admiration. My father had actually graduated from a Jesuit high school, even though he was a Southern Baptist in New Orleans. That's a whole other story. And she had a real admiration for that style of learning. And as it happened, all of those schools were using what we would now call a classical education model. And so she wrote away for curricula and descriptions of what they were doing and put together a homeschool curricula for us from that. So she likes to say that she gave us a classical education without really knowing what she was doing. It was just an education that she admired and wanted us to have. So those are my twin involvements in home education, which was definitely a pragmatic decision on the part of our family, and classical education, which she saw as the best fit for what she wanted for us educationally.
Yeah. And as we get into this, it's kind of funny. You said she didn't know what she was doing, and yet it was classical. Mm-hmm. And now we're critiquing people who think they're doing classical but don't know what they're doing.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, classical education is above all a pattern. It is not a set of precepts or a set of books. It is a pattern of learning. And that's what she was able to reproduce for us. But I want to be really clear that classical education and homeschooling are not the same thing. Particularly now. So, I mean, I have been in now the homeschooling world since 1972, I guess. I homeschooled my own four children. I have spoken at homeschooling conventions. I consult with homeschool parents. I own a company that publishes material for homeschoolers. And people who pursue a classical methodology while homeschooling are a, you know, healthy, but still relatively small slice of the homeschooling pie. Homeschooling is this big, disorderly, chaotic, really interesting segment of the educational universe, which is primarily, I think, run by parents saying, I don't have a better option. We're just going to do this ourselves. And there are so many different ways that parents homeschool. Classical methodology is just one, I would say, actually relatively small part of that fairly large movement.
Dr. Bauer has been doing this for a while, becoming a leading voice in one of these neoclassical strands. I was public schooled up until college and couldn't have told you the difference between a public school and a classical school because I never heard of a classical school up until 5 years ago. That might be a lot of you. Or maybe you grew up in a Christian classical school and this is all you knew. You couldn't define it to someone. You lived it. So I asked Dr. Bauer to help define what classical education is.
Well, let me actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to rephrase that question.
Please do.
The issue is not so much whether a classical school is a classical or what makes a classical school, because I speak at a lot of classical schools. I do a lot of teacher training, and a lot of teachers in classical schools don't really know why what they're doing is distinctive or different from the teacher training that they came out of at a state university or from the private Christian school they were at before. Classical education has become a label that gets pasted over a lot of different enterprises in which there isn't necessarily a real commitment to what classical schooling is. So if I could just start out by talking about what classical education is, then we can maybe talk about how that applies to the school environment.
Yep.
Okay. Here's the big secret about classical education. There is no such thing. Everybody who does classical, quote unquote, classical education, and that is from the Middle Ages up through the Renaissance of classical education, which really starts with Dorothy Sayers in the 1920s. That includes Charlotte Mason, who was a classical educator. That includes Doug Wilson, who put this label Christian on it and turned it into something else. That includes me. That includes more recent practitioners such as Jessica Hooten Wilson. All of us are doing what I would call a neoclassical education. Okay. So if we were to take it on its most basic terms, classical education is what the Greeks and Romans did.
Mm-hmm.
And classical education for the Greeks and Romans meant that you mastered a certain number of set texts. And these were very, very small, right? Because, you know, there was no printing. There just weren't that many texts. Even what we now think of as classical basics, such as, you know, such as the works of Socrates, had just actually been collected orally and passed along. There just weren't that many texts. In classical education, if we're talking about Greece and Rome, what was really distinctive about it was this technique of imitation. So students were taught not by encouraging them to think independently, to think creatively, to really grapple with problems. Students were taught by having them imitate people who were better at writing, better at thinking, better at rhetoric, better at arithmetic than they were. So the emphasis in classical education was on modeling yourself on someone who had already accomplished what it was that you wanted to do. That was how Greek and Roman education worked. None of us are only doing that now. I mean, I often say to people, if you really want to argue about what is the most classical education, this is stupid because it would mean the slaves do the teaching, no girls get to partake at all, and you get beaten if you don't do your work properly. None of this are we reproducing. What modern classical or what I would call neoclassical education is really based on is a medieval reworking of that classical tradition. So between the 5th and 8th centuries, when the Roman political machine, which had a extensive educational component to it, fell apart, the task of educating students was largely picked up in Europe by cathedral schools. And the whole point of a cathedral school was to train men for the priesthood. The goal here was to make sure that youth were educated well enough to be able to qualify as future clergymen. In order to do this, medieval schools, which picked up on this classical education, and you may know that was one of the aspects of the Middle Ages, was this reverence for the classical past. Medieval schools took Greek and Roman priorities and said the most important thing to do is to master what they called the trivium. Mm-hmm. Which is grammar, the basic building blocks of a subject, logic, which is figuring out how those subjects fit together, and rhetoric, being able to express yourself fluently in any field to convince other people. And you can see how those are things that would be really useful for clergymen, because clergymen needed to be able to read and speak and convince other people. So that was really the center of the revival of classical education in the Middle Ages. Now, there was a whole other aspect to Roman and Greek education, which was they also had something. The trivium is obviously three, try. But they also had what they called the quadrivium in Greek and Roman education, which was arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. Those were considered to be the only fields of knowledge that needed to be mastered. Nobody today talks about the quadrivium because arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music don't really do it for us anymore. There's so much more, right, that we need to know. So already you can see that anybody who's doing classical education has already departed from the ancient past. So what happened in the 1920s is that the British novelist and thinker Dorothy Sayers pulled this idea of the trivium, and she had been educated at Oxford, which was an heir of this medieval way of education, pulled the trivium back out, married it to early 20th century work on child development, and said, you know, grammar, logic, and rhetoric really pair up with the developmental stages of a child's mind. Mm-hmm. Grammar is when you absorb the building blocks of a subject. And that is really what we're doing with elementary aged students, basically, you know, grades 1 through 4, is we're giving them information and letting them just suck it up. Logic means that you begin to think critically about that information. And we know that the capacity to think critically and to deal with abstractions tends to develop more in the middle grades, more of what we would think of as junior high and early high school. And then rhetoric, which is the art of self-expression, follows on those two and is more of a high school level study. So anybody who talks about neoclassical education in the 21st century is working with this amalgam of an ancient Greek and Roman tradition developed by the medieval cathedral schools and then further articulated by early 20th century educators hand in hand with new studies into the development of a child's brain. That is classical education.
As stated before, Dr. Bauer is but one of many approaches to neoclassical education. There is no the classical education. There are classical approaches. Dr. Bauer continues by describing these approaches, who they're influenced by, and what marks them.
I mean, there are definitely other aspects to how classical, neoclassical education is practiced in the present day. I would say that, to me, the most lasting and valuable aspects of this pattern are that if you really take seriously this grammar, logic, rhetoric progression, and I often say this when I do teacher training and talk to homeschool groups, the goal is not to squelch a student's development, right? So your 7-year-old keeps saying, but why? But why? But why? And also obviously wants to think critically. So you don't say, I'm sorry, we don't do that until you're in middle school. Yeah, we're not there yet. The goal is to protect children from being asked to do things that are developmentally inappropriate. So in a non-classical, and I hate to even use that word because education is such a big field, but in many, let me put it this way. In many public school curricula, particularly those that are testing focused, there is an impulse to push more mature thinking tasks back to younger and younger ages. So you are consistently asking second and third and fourth graders to analyze and to try to think critically at a time when they're still trying to figure out how to get through the class period without having to go to the bathroom. You know, it's just not time for them to do that yet. So the classical pattern, I feel, is incredibly useful because it says, no, you don't have to do that yet. You can just learn. You can just memorize. You can just absorb information. This next part will come when your brain is a little bit more mature. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've said to parents, the only problem with this kid is that you need to let the sun go around, you know, the earth go around the sun another time.
Exactly.
That's going to fix it, right? So the classical pattern, I think, is a really useful corrective towards the tendency of the many test-focused educational systems to make younger and younger children do more and more so that it looks like you have high academic achievement, when in fact what you're asking kids to do is something they're just not ready to do.
Now that we've laid a little groundwork defining what classical methodology is and its various strands and approaches, we'll meet Jill Wright. Her sons attended the Oaks Academy, sort of the sister school and rival to the Lagos School in Moscow. Let's get to know her.
I'm Jill Wright. I have two sons that went to the Oaks starting in 2005. I am a certified teacher K-8, as well as a master's degree K-12. And after having my firstborn, I really did my due diligence on knowing what his temperament was, wanting to have him have the best education. And I really struggled in school. I was a late reader. I just did not like school. I cried all the time. And I just really wanted to make sure that I was making the best decision, you know, for my firstborn. And so I knew that there was lots of different alternative education out there, Montessori, homeschooling, different private schools. And so I went and I interviewed to see where he would do his best. And ultimately, I have two sons that are very different in temperament. My oldest was really timid, a lot more quiet, just needed more, not so much rules, but he loved to just like know what was to be expected. Sure. And so I really felt like finding an environment where other kids follow the rules, he would do really well. So I had two cousins who had been homeschooled and ended up finishing their high school, did 2 years at the Oaks. And so it was just kind of coming into my understanding. And I had a cousin who taught there. And so I really respected and their experiences and how they raised their kids. So that was one of the schools on my list. Also, when I went and observed, I had known people that graduated with me from Gonzaga University, that's kids were at that school. In our education program. And so I loved the fact that there was this choral responding and there was movement because the kids would stand to speak. They were learning public speaking. They had direct instruction. And that for me was really important because I was just so clueless in school. I had no idea what was important or what wasn't important. And so I thought this style of learning, and especially kindergarten, was just half day. And I just thought, oh, this is perfect. He wouldn't go to preschool. And I felt like, you know what, I can, you know, really get to, you know, help him and still have that environment, you know, with us as a family, younger brother involved in that. And just really have education be all encompassing. And I love the fact that, you know, the teachers just, I thought they would be really welcoming and Christian and small environment. And so that he would be noticed because, you know, he was so quiet and he did, you know, like to observe, took him a while to warm up. So we then met with Bruce Williams. He was the headmaster at that time. And I just had a list of questions and I did the application and kind of was nervous about, you know, would he get in? I don't know. It was just like, this is such a big, important thing. And I had gone through, you know, so much due diligence to figure out where, you know, he would fit in that once we, you know, started there and cutest uniform, you know, the white shirt, button down, the tie, you know, the dress shoes. I mean, just it was, you know, he took school seriously too. And he was in a class where there was, I think, six girls and one other boy. So it was a very small class size. And yeah.
Next, Jill talks about her awareness of Doug Wilson, what attracted her to a classical Christian school, and what she was helpful for in a school like that.
I think it's helpful highlighting even your background, like you said, because you're trained in education. You're trained in the art of education. So I think I'm gonna keep that in the forefront of people's minds, because that's going to play a pretty big part as we get through this.
Yeah.
And another interviewee guest on this show, Natasha Chile, she was also at Oaks at the same time that you guys were there too. So if people want to go back to Natasha, and that'll be in the midst of this episode too. So it's not just one perspective, it's multiple perspectives on the same school that accord with each other. And especially, I think, not like you're more important than Natasha, but I think you've got some background in this to know what's expected of a school, what the education should be like, what the curriculum is like, what the teachers should be doing, how they should be interacting with kids, the range of kids that are coming to the school. So we're going to keep it on the forefront. So yeah, you were at an ACCS school, so Association of Christian Classical Schools, founded by Doug Wilson, I think, in 94. I think that's the year that was founded, or it was sometime in the mid-90s, at the very least, in 94. Were you aware of Wilson at this point, or how did you become or introduced to Wilson and his association with the ACCS?
Yeah, that wasn't until 2004. And I didn't even really know about the ACCS, except it was when my oldest was, I think, in first grade, they were going through the accreditation.
Okay.
And I had really no idea. I just, you know, kind of thought, oh, you know, it's like any, you know, school that, you know, has a standard that they just really want to make sure that, you know, people know that they're not out there, that they actually have some legitimate things that they're teaching that's not so out there.
Yeah. Yeah. So you weren't aware when you first started. When did you become aware of Wilson and the influence of Wilson, even whether that be bad or good? When did that first start coming up?
Well, at the first meeting with Bruce Williams, he gave us the book. I think it was Restoring the Ruins. And also, like, my family did say, this is a good education, but the theology is a little bit out there. So just make sure that you're, that you kind of, you know, keep, you know, invested in what they're doing. But, you know, it's a really good, rigorous education, and it's a liberal arts. And, you know, there was real emphasis on etiquette and manners. And it felt like there was a lot of graces that could be learned there, and then just have this, you know, love of learning, which was what I really wanted, because I'm in education, but it was not an easy road for me.
One of the hallmarks, if not the hallmark, of a Christian classical education is rigor. If public schools in the U.S. have fallen on hard times, which they have, and are not training kids as they used to, which they aren't, the classical school is the opposite. They will work you into the ground. In this scenario, classical equals nearly impossible. A fourth grader reads Ovid. A sixth grader reads Homer. A 10th grader reads them in Latin, Greek, English, and maybe even Spanish. Now, I find nothing wrong in any of these educational goals, but it's when they become expectations, they become marketable. Here's Dr. Bauer on how education is traded for rigor, what it does to kids, and then how marketable it is.
Yes, and that's where I think if you have a classical school, which is in fact really pushing kids to do more earlier, you've got a school that is departing from what I would see as the helpful neoclassical model. And you know, this has been going on for a long time. So back in the 1970s, early 1970s, when private Christian schools were still a very, very new thing, and unfortunately, in many cases, private classical schools were an attempt to avoid desegregation.
Yep,
so
we're well aware. Yep.
So private Christian schools were white. But there was a private school curricula publisher, teacher training called Abeka. So Abeka, aware that they didn't have a track record and that private Christian schooling was a new thing, made themselves, I should say, staked their reputation on see how fast we can make kids do things. So if you did an Abeka curriculum, you started first grade math in kindergarten and you started doing cursive in kindergarten, because in public schools, kids didn't learn cursive until second grade. But in Abeka, you'd started it in kindergarten. And this was just a demonstration of the fact that the school was academically superior because younger kids were doing harder things. You do see that in a number of classical curricula. So, for example, the Veritas Press curricula have seventh graders reading the Aeneid.
Oh my gosh.
Every time I see that, I'm like, okay, it's in their omnibus, which a lot of both classical schools and homeschoolers who are using a classical model do use. I look at that and look, I taught college freshmen for 20 years at the College of William & Mary, okay?
Yeah, difficult for college freshmen.
Oh my goodness. I'm like, okay, first of all, have you ever read the Aeneid? And second, have you ever met a seventh grader? Why are you doing this? Well, you're doing it because it sounds good, right? It sounds quote unquote rigorous.
Yeah, so you can put in your brochure, look at how smart our kids are. We make them read the Aeneid at this age.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a number of classical schools that just as a matter of course, again, start first grade math in kindergarten, because then they can point at that as a measure of academic excellence. And in my view, that is an act of either insecurity or arrogance and is not consonant with the values of classical education.
Jill saw this firsthand. Her kids experienced this firsthand. She saw the stress that kids were under. The brain of the child is still developing, and we'll get there, but the school is too worried about training the next Christian soldier. They forget that education is foremost formative. Here's what Jill saw.
They were aware that your background is in education, so you knew what you were you were talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. But they would always dismiss it because it was government school, right, that I had taught in. But they would also just reach for the 7 rules of learning or something. I can probably find this real quick. That they would always reference. And all of those things that they were referencing were research-based that I had studied and I knew. It's just they didn't implement it in a way that was helpful. They didn't understand reinforcement schedules. They didn't understand how you can create a lesson plan by starting with an anticipatory set, and then you can give them practice on it or reflect before they leave so they know what's the most important information. They just had these, well, this is classical, but ultimately what we found was that they really did not think that everyone could learn. And that was not the point of the school. The point of the school of learning and spending time in homework was because then that would reflect you being able to spend time in prayer. So their whole goal was not that you would study something to actually learn the outcome of it. It was you should love everything equally. And when you're in that time of trying to struggle with what you're learning, that is what brings glory to God. That is the most important. And I didn't sign up for that. I really felt like we were sending our kids to a school. They told us it was a school. There was curriculum and there was outcomes. And I don't think that people knew that ultimately, they really thought of they use the bell curve, even though they do have points for each thing, that if there were too many students getting A's, the teacher wasn't doing their job. So you had to make it harder. You had to make it tougher. There had to have been students failing.
Yeah, that's why the bell curve, I guess that makes sense why they use the bell curve, because if there's too many top end scores, then that messes up, I guess, whatever the average is. And so their curriculum must not be hard enough to evenly distribute the grades out.
So here's another aspect of them not being teachers.
Okay.
When you are a teacher, you are a mandated reporter. Okay. They are not mandated reporters. None of them. There was an instance where a family was eventually reported to CPS, but when it was brought to Charlie Dowers, he did not want to hear it. And he ultimately believes, and this is what was told when we met with Bruce Williams, is that the family is responsible and they don't want to get involved in that. And it's a real concern. Because there are abuses that happen, and teachers can do such an important part in, you know, helping. And and there's also no background checks.
Really?
Now, as you've heard already, there is no single way of approaching classical education. In fact, classical education doesn't exist. Classical methodologies do. It's not a reading list on a brochure to hand to parents with Harvard in their eyes and the next Albert Einstein or Marie Curie at home. There's a continuum. There are approaches. There are methodologies. Classical education is decidedly not one size fits all. It's a way of educating rather than the education itself. Dr. Bauer continues.
Do you know the first scene of the original Mean Girls movie where she comes on
and she says,
I'm homeschooled. You know what that means?
To people? I know exactly what you're talking about. Yep.
Okay. So that scene is actually, I feel like, a really useful guide to most of the subsets of homeschoolers.
I like it. Perfect.
Yeah. So I have 72, 82, 92. Oh, wow. I have literally been involved with homeschooling for over 40 years. As a student, as a parent of four homeschooled children, as a consultant to homeschoolers, I have spoken at homeschool conventions. If you Google homeschooling, you'll probably find our website where we have, you know, my publishing company has one of the largest message boards on the web for homeschoolers. So I have a pretty extensive overview of what's going on in homeschooling. So I'm going to give you the pocket version here. Homeschooling started out in the 1970s primarily as a way of kicking the establishment in the teeth. So the people who were doing it were either on a mountain somewhere or, in the case of my parents, looked and said, this school is so broken. There's no way I'm putting my kids in it. I'm just going to do it myself. Throughout the 1970s, and then particularly in the 1980s, homeschooling developed a really strong grassroots movement of homeschool parents who were taking that initial impulse of, you know, kicking the authorities in the teeth and marrying it to a separatist theology that said, we are Christians and therefore our children cannot be in a government school because it will corrupt them, it will indoctrinate them, and it will make them weaker. And the way that we are going to raise a strong Christian family is by keeping them away from any government influences. So it got to be not just a kicking the educational establishment in the teeth, which, you know, every establishment deserves to be kicked in the teeth and told to get their act together, but particularly an anti-government bent to it. And that what happened in the 1980s is that homeschooling has always been an intensely decentralized movement. One thing that fundamentalists are really, really great at is organizing.
Okay.
So in the 1980s, particularly as each state set about dealing with the growing phenomenon of homeschooling and figuring out what regulations to place on it, in particular, separatist Protestant parents organized into state organizations, grassroots groups, basically to lobby their state organizations to not regulate homeschooling.
Yep.
These organizations turned into what we now think of as state homeschooling organizations. Almost every organization that calls itself a state homeschool organization, and I have to tell new homeschoolers this all the time, is a conservative Protestant Christian organization.
Yep.
And it's not always obvious from their front page. But they say, you know, new homeschooler, come to our Learn How to Homeschool. What they're actually doing is drawing you into their particular conservative, anti-government Protestant net. Okay, that sounded more pejorative than I meant it to. Net sounds bad.
Don't worry, we make it sound worse during this series. You're not going to sound that bad.
Oh, no, I'm sure. So even now, if you're a new homeschooler, you know, it's 2024, and you go and you type homeschooling, the first 50 things that pop up are going to be all anti-government conservative Protestant organizations, even if that isn't completely clear. There are secular homeschool organizations out there, but they are much more dispersed. They've got a lot less energy behind them because, again, this is just something that fundamentalist Protestants do really, really well. So as a result of that, these are the organizations that collect dues. They put together homeschool conventions. They invite vendors. If you go to any big fair, and there are huge homeschool fairs where you can go and check out all of these different vendors, what you're actually seeing there are primarily people who have been invited and vetted by these homeschool organizations for particular theological points of view. That's kind of the surface of homeschooling. However, technology has problems, but here it is. We're dealing with it. And sometimes there are huge benefits. The internet began to sort of break that stranglehold on homeschooling, homeschooling products, homeschooling curricula, and homeschooling methods. So there is also a pretty massive upswell of people who are homeschooling who are not anti-government. Their school's just not working for them. They are not conservative Protestants. They just really are looking for an educational solution that is right for their family. So these are these two. And in that, there's so many different than people that are lumped into this. I don't hate the government. It's just that school's not working for me, homeschoolers. There's so many. There are atheists. There are secularists. There are we personally, I know I have spoken to Orthodox Jewish groups. I have spoken to groups of, they just, you know, call themselves the Association of Black Homeschoolers, which is just like, all of these homeschooling organizations are white. What's that all about? I mean, there's so many different homeschooling groups out there. The most visible ones, however, continue to be the conservative Protestant anti-government homeschoolers. You'll notice that none of this has anything to do with classical education.
No.
Right. Because classical education is a methodology that doesn't have anything to do with homeschooling or school. It's a pedagogical choice. You can be a homeschooler and pursue a classical methodology. You can have a school and put a classical methodology into place in your school, but not all schools are classical and not all homeschoolers are classical. These are two different things.
Now, for those methodologies, maybe you're like me and you've Googled or are Googling classical reading list, great books programs, Western canon for reading. But classical cannot be boiled down to any one of those search terms, though it can include them. At its foundation, classical education is a way of educating, not the what of education. And Dr. Bauer explains.
Well, you know, I don't want to take too much credit or blame for this, but my mother and I co-wrote a book called The Well-Trained Mind, A Guide to Classical Education at Home. First edition came out in 1999. It's been through five editions since. And it sort of became the go-to handbook for people who were interested in classical education.
Yeah.
That book, particularly in the first 4 or 5 years, kind of, I don't know, it did actually take the private and homeschooling educational world by storm in a way. And my mother and I both noticed 4 or 5 years after the initial publication that a lot of curricula were suddenly calling themselves classical that had been around for a number of years and had not in their essence changed. But classical had become a useful marketing term. I think that impulse is alive and well. So, I mean, I just recently had correspondence with an online school which called itself classical, and I went on their website and was trying to figure out what made them classical. And I finally emailed and said, why are you using the word classical? Because I don't see anything on your website that is distinctively classical. And the answer that I got back was, well, we read the great books, by which they meant Western canonical texts.
Yep.
Well, okay. I mean, that is not an illegitimate use of the word classical, but it's one very small segment of what I would think of as classical. So there are schools that call themselves classical that do actually use the methodology that I've described. There are schools that call themselves classical because it's a trendy term and it makes parents think my kids are getting a great education. But what you're really getting is just sort of a standard, good, probably, but just a standard liberal arts education. And there are schools that call themselves classical because kids are reading mostly the what are considered the canonical texts of Western literature. And those are three different things. So as with any label, you got to get a little deeper and find out what it is exactly that they're talking about.
Yeah. If you had to describe your approach to classical methodology. And not to say that your approach is the approach, it's just one of the approaches. Like you said, this is a continuum. Well, how would Susan describe her approach to classical methodology?
Well, my focus would really be on those three stages of development of the child's mind, right? On the grammar stage, really just absorbing information. I'm a parent of four and a grandmother of one. I have observed this firsthand as well as in many other students. When kids are in that elementary stage, they have a great thirst just to know, a great love for information for the sake of information. And so you're kind of following the child's lead and saying, yes, this is what we're going to do. We're going to read every book on every topic, and you can ask all of the questions and we'll find out more about it. And then as they move into that middle grade stage, they start to get a little bit more discriminating. Sometimes they seem a little crankier because they're questioning you a lot more. That's the development of that critical thinking capacity, which is so important. You can't go on in life until you develop the ability to be distrustful. That's a big part of what the logic stage is about, is saying, you say this is true, but why? How do I know? I don't think I believe you. That's a really big part of logic stage learning. And then moving on into high school, really teaching students to express their own opinions with grace and fluency. I always say when I present, that's how I think of the core of neoclassical education. I always say when I talk about this to parents and teachers that you have to recognize that that pattern matches the development of a child's social and emotional being, as well as their intellectual being. That young children just want to, they just love everything, and they want to wallow in all of the information, and they don't want you to stop and interrogate them about it. They just love life, you know. Then as you're moving into the middle grades, they have to develop some suspicion of the adults around them, because you don't want them to be trusting everybody. You don't want them to be accepting everything that they're told. You want them to be skeptical. You want them to think through if they're being sold a bill of goods or whether this is actually true. And then as they move into high school, students have this immense need to be individuals, to express themselves, to say, this is who I am. I am not my parents. I am not my siblings. I am not my friends. I am I. And rhetoric, which is the ability to express what you think and what you believe fluently and persuasively, is such a huge part of developing self-identity. That's what I see as really valuable and central to neoclassical education.
It's when classical is defined as the what of education rather than the how that we tend to run into difficulties. When classical education and homeschooling, so often compared, are boiled down to a reading list or a graduated curriculum of Latin Greek readings, memorization cards, and ancient Greco-Roman literature, the how becomes less important. The teacher enforces the list, gets you to memorize, and quizzes you on the reading, or asks for papers to explain various aspects of it. Teaching becomes less a formative profession as it becomes a coercive one. The how of teaching becomes less important than the product of teaching. Both are important, but so often these teachers are never trained how to teach. They're just told what to teach and measured accordingly. This leads to a score of pedagogical difficulties because teachers don't know how to teach. Here's Dr. Bauer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my experience of doing teacher training at classical schools is that the majority of teachers there don't understand what classical education is or what it is that they're supposed to be doing. They have come straight out of another private school. They have come straight out of teacher training at their local state university where they just got an education degree. And nobody has taken the time to stop and train them about the stages of education, why they're important, and how teaching strategies should change from second grade to sixth grade to 11th grade. And there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, of course, there are always institutional reasons why schools don't do what they say they're doing or don't do it well, because schools are chronically underfunded and teachers are chronically underpaid and undertrained, right? So I don't think classical schools are any more guilty of that than any other school. But the label classical should at least mean that the faculty has a clear view of how what they're doing is different from the school down the road. And it has not been my experience that that's true. Now, what is easier than giving teachers a full understanding of here is the classical methodology, here are the challenges you're going to face with each age, here's how you've got to adjust, here's how much work you're going to have to put in, here's how much the parents are going to have to pay if they want this kind of education. What's easier is just to have a list of texts and say, we are a classical school because our fourth graders are reading the Decameron, and our seventh graders are reading the Aeneid, and our 11th graders are reading the Odyssey in the original Greek. Yeah. That's, well, there are a lot of schools that put that up, though, as a model, and that's easy. Huh. A set of texts is easy. Real teaching is difficult. So I do feel that there is a tendency, again, because it's simple, it's straightforward, it's easy to define, to turn classical education into a list of approved texts. And what comes along with that is a willingness to shed the students who either don't want to or can't grapple with those texts at the age when you say they should. I had a really disturbing conversation with an administrator of a very well-known classical Christian school in Pennsylvania, where I said, and I can't remember whether I was consulting or whether he had just called me up to bawl me out about something that I wrote that he didn't think was consonant with theology. I can't remember, to be honest. But I said, you know, the lists of set texts that you have for your middle school and high school students mean you're going to lose over half of your students in every grade because they're just not going to be developmentally ready to deal with the difficulty of those texts. And he said to me, that's our goal.
I knew that was going to be his response the moment you asked that question.
Yep. That's our goal. We only want the cream of the crop. It's
fine. We
want
to leave them out. If that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
If that's what it takes, that's what it takes. Well, that is completely opposite to the goal of any conscientious educator. The goal of education is to bring students along and make them more themselves, more aware of what is going on around them, more equipped to deal with difficult questions, not to shed the ones who don't learn in your particular framework. And I find that appalling.
Because of these difficulties, when the teachers themselves don't know what they're doing or what they're teaching or what classical education is, they run into students who cannot keep up and begin acting out. You run into discipline. Because if the student can't keep up because the school is hard to be hard, the student who can't handle the stress and even those who bottle it up begin acting out. You've got to keep them in line. Here's Jill on what might happen.
I do not want someone else to spank our kids. And as a behavior analyst, as a person that was, you know, that studied all of this, like it went against everything in me, but I felt like they had some really strict standards. Like, you know, it wasn't for every misbehavior. It was, you know, for very, can't think of the word that I'm trying to think of.
It might've been for like, serious infractions or moral infractions, whatever it may have been. Cause we've also heard too that Oaks would send report cards, not just for grades, but for like morals. Like if you were a good person or bad person in school, whatever it may have been. And I think for a lot of parents, when you have such a structured school system and everything is structured to the T, and like you said, the kids have like, they're supposed to be sitting in a certain way or else something could happen. It makes not spanking more digestible, but it fits in a system versus it just being kind of a random one-off, which is, I think, easier for them to sell on the front end that this is in a system, not itself. But that's not exactly how it turned out in anybody's case.
It's so our youngest son, Tristan, was spanked.
He had gotten school.
Yes, by Bruce Williams. And it became kind of the funny story because Tristan had been crying. And so Bruce had given him a Kleenex. And so when he went, he told Tristan, you can go ahead and throw that away. And the paddle was right next to him. So Tristan picked up the paddle and threw that away, you know, and Bruce meant, oh, you know, you need to throw the Kleenex away because you need to be courageous. You can't be a boy crying, you know, when you're getting a spanking. So, but again, like that was one of the first times where I'm like, oh, wait, we were supposed to be called prior.
Oh, you weren't called for that.
We weren't called. We were just told after the fact. And then we were told that funny story, you know.
But even though, like, they told you on the front end, at least the contract that you guys had signed with the school and the expectation, regardless of what people think of spanking in the educational environment, you were told that you would be notified previous to any spanking or whatever may have happened. And that's not what happened in this case.
And then when I was an aide and I went to a back to school, you know, meeting, the staff meeting, Bruce Williams said that he'd never told any parent that, but other teachers had even said, no, you used to say this. And he said, that's not, I would never have said that. I don't know why, you know, you guys, you know, have said that. So, but along with spanking, I was told by a good friend who'd been there for a few years in front of me, which I really respected her and wanted, you know, to gain, you know, some wisdom from. Her son had a mild form of cerebral palsy. Yep. And in second grade, he would fall out of his chair.
Mm-hmm.
And
not intentionally, because that's what cerebral palsy does.
But because it happened and it was disrupting the classroom environment and the teacher didn't know what to do, and this was part of the rules, and more than likely she had been told, you know, to look for, you know, misbehavior. And so, you know, that did occur. And that was just like, but she had been called. She had been called. So she did get to be, to be part of that. And she felt like it went very well, that they handled it as best they could, you know? So it's just.
Yeah. Regardless, the kid had cerebral palsy. And so it's not like falling is what he's trying to intentionally do.
Yeah. I mean, very mild. So like, you know, but again,
yeah,
there's just that those things that make you an individual are not recognized at all.
But that goes into what you're saying, the authoritarian structure of the school, the fear-based instruction and punishment, that you said the classroom management isn't there because it's based on it's based on a controlled behavior modification, not a scientifically based, research-based understanding of how do we teach kids, how do we keep in line, how do we keep the classroom on topic and engaged. How do we scare them into staying engaged?
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, the hypervigilance of these kids too, you know, it was palpable.
There's so much focus on the what of education that the how becomes rigid. There is one way to do it, and a certain kind of student who excels. Whereas all students should be guided towards their greatest end, whatever that may be. For some, it's more difficult than others. But this is not at competition with a classical model of education. And this brings us to a testy subject, because this discipline is so often Christianized. The formation of character is molded by a strict and narrow understanding of the Christian faith. Christian classical education becomes less concerned with the vast repository of human knowledge and virtue formation. Dr. Bauer gives her thoughts on the Christian label attached to so many classical schools and what that really means.
So this thing called classical Christian is grounded in a particular strand of Reformed theology. And I actually have a Master of Divinity from a quite conservative Reformed seminary. So I do know
we went to sister
some
schools. You went to Westminster, Philly. I went to Westminster, California.
Oh, did you? Okay. All right. actually, you know, Westminster, Philadelphia, when I went there, which was like 88 to 91, I think, was in a bit of a renaissance, which unfortunately then turned around and went in the opposite direction. but so the classical Christian education movement is grounded in this very specific form of Reformed theology, which says that there is no way to know anything apart from faith in God.
Yep.
Including, and I've had this discussion with so many people in the classical Christian education sphere, you can't even trust that 2 + 2 = 4 unless you have been redeemed. And let me just say again, okay, I am actually a Christian. I cannot tell you how many times I have said, people, even Calvin believed in common grace.
Yeah. Well, he was trained under this methodology himself and a lawyer, nonetheless.
No, absolutely. So Calvin had a classical education because he was trained. His education grew out of that whole.
Yeah. Read book one of the Institutes and see how often he quotes scripture versus the Greco-Roman philosophers and poets.
Yes. No. Absolutely. Absolutely. So this whole like founding idea under most schools and curricula, which label themselves as classical Christian, is this deep distrust of the human brain. Which, again, as an educator, as a historian, as a person with advanced degrees, and as a parent, I just find super appalling. I mean, what are we doing here? I think this actually explains a lot of what's going on politically in our country right now, is that if your assumption is that people who don't share my theological beliefs are incapable of understanding the truth, why would you have any conversations with them? Why would you do anything except strong arm them into doing what you want to do? So I have not yet found something that I would call classical Christian education that does not take that stance. And maybe I am wrong and maybe it is out there. But classical Christian, in my experience, almost exclusively means that if you are not a Christian, if you are not redeemed by God in whatever way you put this, you are incapable of understanding or learning, and there is no truth in you. And all you have to do, I know I wasn't going to say this, is read anything that Doug Wilson has ever written about Christian education.
If people heard our original conversation, you would know how surprised I am that Susan is bringing this up.
Because actually, Peter, before we started talking, I went back to just reread the prefaces of a couple of the most recent books he's done on education, and it's right there. If you are not redeemed by God, which means chosen by God, it doesn't have anything to do with your will, then you are incapable of understanding truth. That has never been the basis of classical education, which had an immense respect for our ability to look at and understand the natural world. You know, our entire scientific, all of our scientific accomplishments, which is maybe why classical Christian schools tend to be a little light on the science, our entire scientific tradition is based on the assumption that if you look at the world, you can understand things about it. Whether or not you have been called by God to join the kingdom of God, that doesn't have anything to do with it, right? So if you're looking at something that calls itself classical Christian, I would be very reluctant, and as a parent, to put my child in that school until I got some answers to that question. Do you think that my child can understand true things about the world apart from the Christian faith? I just really think that is a foundational question that too many people are not asking. Right. So what I see myself as doing with The Well-Trained Mind, The Well-Educated Mind, other books that I've written about education, is trying to recapture the term classical, which has gotten co-opted by this hyper-reformed theology, and say, no, we're going back to what is actually classical, which both, by the way, Calvin and Luther would agree with me.
Pretty much all the reformers were
all the reformers.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. You can understand the world apart from your faith commitment because of common grace. I mean, it seems so basic to me, but there has definitely been a flag planted that says the only true education is classical Christian. And I don't think the word classical belongs in that construct.
And one example of this is what Jill Wright saw and experienced at the Oaks Academy, pervasive throughout so many ACCS schools. We'll begin broader, the basic theological underpinnings of the ACCS, whose theology and specific Christian tradition it espouses and teaches. It doesn't teach you how to think, but what to think. Here's Jill.
Yeah.
But before I ask some of the leading but concluding questions based off of all this, I still kind of want to push into the patriarchy. I mean, because our series is called Sons of Patriarchy. So this is a big part of what we're doing. So you said the moms weren't really respected. Women weren't really respected. Did they have female teachers at the school? Like, how were female teachers or female students? How were they treated compared to the male students, male teachers? Yeah.
So grammar school had primarily women teachers.
Uh-huh.
Kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. Okay, fifth grade and sixth grade. That's when we had male grammar teachers. Logic stage, there was like a handful, like maybe four or five. I don't even really know how many teachers are at the Oaks, mm-hmm. quite frankly. But what was interesting to me was that they did have a woman teaching math in the high school, and then an English teacher who was really, really good. But they've moved both of those into the logic. So seventh, eighth. And I don't think that there was any women teaching the high schoolers. And if there was, they would split it into female and males so that the woman was only teaching the girls.
So was that have anything to do with they didn't want women teaching older boys?
Men. I didn't even cross my mind because I didn't understand this theology. I mean, we were there for an education and we knew the Bible teachers were always Christ Church, but we just were thinking and ultimately I think beforehand they were just using who they could, right?
Sure,
and
sure.
To grow, then they really maybe started to, make some different plans. So, but again, I didn't even know this until we left. Like once I left and I felt like, why do I feel so betrayed? Like, why is it that I want my kids to graduate from there when I can see the distress? And I had so blatantly called it out and asked, surveys to be done, am I crazy? I just felt like I was the crazy one, and we were kind of all isolated, right? You were meant to feel like you were an isolated experience and other people were doing great, and if you just, held the line and got them past 16, then, everything would be good. And so then I started looking at the theology and looking into Doug Wilson and looking into, Christ Church and then you just ding, 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 ding. My gosh, I was in a behavioral control. I was in information control. I was, thought terminating things, Bible verses thrown all out at you. And, just the environment was stifling. And then when I realized, just the sin and the shame, those weren't developmental. Those were critical to class instruction. My kids would come home and they're like, oh man, we got another lecture in math about, whatever topic. And they had homework, and it was they just didn't get that extra, you know, practice, but that moral, you know, thing was so important. And so then there was hypervigilance, the kids in the hallways, like it was quiet, like, you know, kids are not talking and happy. And if a teacher walks by, then they would turn and smile. It was just masking all over the place and isolation, because the homework was really, I mean, they did, it was busy work. It was superfluous. It was just like,
It was hard to be hard, not for educational purposes, but hard to be hard.
Absolutely. And so then, you know, kids weren't in necessarily in sports. I mean, there were a rare few, you know, that, but, you know, then those kids were just exhausted because they were getting home late and then having homework. And then that was rewarded. Like the busier you are, you know, the holier you are. But you, then it just, you know, the kids just felt powerless. You could just see, and you could just see the distress, and you can just see the desperation. And I think that, you know, for me, it was like, we were, I understood the importance of sleep. I understood the importance of like downtime, like what your brain is doing and how people are learning and what your styles of learning are and how you, you could totally have this wonderful classical education and use all of these wonderful modalities to get the learning and then to generalize that information, you know, to real life. I mean, I had a student tell me, like, I know how to live in the Renaissance. I don't know how to live in modern world, because they've spent so much time, you know, doing those things. And then they're scared to death. The other part is that the Oaks really does emphasize that government school is awful. I mean, in that book, the, you know, Returning the Ruins or what, Restoring the Ruins, like the first page, and I just laughed at it, was basically, how do you destroy government schools? And I'm like, are you serious? Like, what the heck? You know? And so I think I took a lot of what they said with just like, they're, what is it? They don't have a lot of, help me with this word.
Compassion?
F. It starts with an F. I'm trying to figure it out. Oh, now I've totally lost that train of thought. But they, they were a, on the outskirts, like they're thinking.
Fringe.
Fringe. That's the word. Thank you. This might be a good time to, you know, now explain that I was diagnosed at 39 with ADHD. So, that's why school was so hard for me, I think, because I didn't understand. And so I do have a real heart for individuals that are struggling in school, and it's not made up. I mean, it's real. I have a difficult time finding words sometimes. And so I go around about, and it's not that I don't have the information. Sometimes it's just hard for me to, and, you know, with that external cerebral cortex, sometimes I need someone's help, or, you know, executing things. Like, I know how to do it. I just can't do it. And it's really, you know, it's hard for me to start, or it's hard for me to end, or I get hyper-focused. And, you know, so then people are like, well, you're too ideological, or, you know, all of this. But it's like, but I've seen how things can work, and I love the students, right? I'm a mentor. I'm a consultant. Those are when I do my best. I can see how someone's teaching, and I can give them ideas to like really encourage that and let them, you know, just, and I've seen kids just flourish when there's just a little bit of giving them maybe more information, or giving them a tool or a trick that how they're going to, you know, learn this. And kids can do well when they're given those, you know, those skills, and when they're in an environment where they feel confident. I really feel like this is an important part, that the school breaks you down as an individual. They take all of the things that make you unique, and then they try and build you into who they want you to be. And the students then don't know how to make decisions, and they are
so not in the system, and the system makes decisions for them.
Right. You're so reliant on being obedient, and you're also so reliant on what is the answer that the teacher wants. because you cannot have a different answer, even if you have done a very good job of proving that point or coming to that conclusion.
That could come across as disobedience. It could come across as you're being prideful, whatever it is. And like they have a mold that the Oaks or one of these schools wants. And if you don't fit that mold, then either you're going to be pushed and squeezed into that mold in any way, shape, or form, which, like you're saying, that plays into the fear environment. It's like I got to fit in some way, somehow. Yeah. And if you don't, then you better watch out because you are sticking out.
Yeah. One other story that I want to.
Yeah.
And maybe you'll address this, but it's when we left, like how it was that we left.
Yep. Yeah. I was going to ask that next. Yeah. What?
This theology gets even further narrowed down to patriarchy. Patriarchy is a lens through which we view the world and one another. Rather than education that helps us ask the questions that allow us to evaluate what we see, experience, and hear, patriarchy becomes a lens through which we're taught to see the world. It's less an education and more an indoctrination. Jill describes further.
So it was very intentional, the patriarchy. The dad was always given the authority.
Okay.
And as much as, you know, the moms were the ones that were dropping off the kids, that were doing the homework, that were, you know, getting, you know, the clothes washed, doing, you know, getting their healthy school lunch, because for the most part, you know, they did put a high emphasis on healthy meals. There's just, you know, there was a kind of a just this culture. And so one of the things is that anytime I would go in to speak with, you know, whatever, the head of the especially the head of the logic school or the, I'm forgetting what they call them, these things.
Yeah.
But Joel, my husband, would always have to come with me. And I would have him do all the speaking. And so I was very much like, you know what? I'm the educated one. I have the data.
Yeah.
But my husband is very good with speaking. And because they, you know, respected the male more than the female, I just allowed my husband to speak for me.
Huh.
Oh, my goodness. That is, it's such an interesting thing. And I
was that like a standard set by the school that it had to be the man?
Absolutely. I mean, and there were so many times that they would just dismiss the women that would come in. So I just decided, well, you know what? I will respect this. This is something that they value. I'll go along with this because my husband and I were such a team. And I really felt like what we had to say was important. And I thought it would be more, you know, well received.
Though these schools and institutions position themselves as places where your kids are formed, they aren't formed into thinkers. They're formed by molds. They're fitted into molds. Men are supposed to be one thing and women another. You're given spectacles to see the world, and questioning them means, to them, that you haven't been fully formed. You don't quite fit. This is opposed to what classical education is for. It doesn't tell you what to think. It teaches you how to think. I love the classical approach to education. I like it more than anything else that is on offer, any other methodology. It's why I critique it, the same with Dr. Bauer and Joe Wright. What does teaching you how to think look like? That's what I asked Dr. Bauer next.
Yeah. So a classical education is definitely not a pragmatic education. It is not an education that is meant as job training. It is not an education that is designed to get you ahead in life. There's nothing wrong with these things. I'm a big fan of job training. I'm a big fan of getting ahead in life. I like having enough money to, you know, go out to eat when I want to go out to eat. But I'm gonna read you two quotes. And the first one is from Aristotle. So this is from Aristotle's Rhetoric. What is the goal of education? He says, "It is absurd that a man should be ashamed of an inability to defend himself with his limbs, but not ashamed of an inability to defend himself with speech and reason. for the use of rational speech is more distinctive of a human being than the use of his limbs. So for Aristotle, you become fully human when you are able to defend what you believe with words. As a writer, I know that you do not fully know what you think on any subject until you put it into words, until you write it down. Yep. I am sure, Peter, that you have an idea in your head of what this podcast is going to be, and you're not going to fully know what that is until you get those words, those words down.
Exactly.
Right. So that is the goal. The goal of a classical education has always been to make people more human, right? More human. And for Aristotle, that means the use of rational speech. And wrapped up in that phrase is not just that you're able to talk well, but that you are able to reason. You are able to understand the world around you and draw meaningful conclusions about it. That's the goal of a classical education. And as classical education then was redeveloped by the cathedral schools, you see this reliance on the development of wisdom through education. So if you look at the Book of Wisdom, there's this wonderful definition which then becomes developed as aspects of a classical education. The quote is from the Book of Wisdom. It is, "Wisdom reaches mightily from one end of the earth to the other, and she orders all things well. Her labors are virtues, for she teaches self-control and prudence, justice and courage. Nothing in life is more profitable than these." So, self-control, prudence, justice, and courage. Those are the four cardinal virtues, which were developed by Thomas Aquinas by way of Plato and Cicero.
Sounds a lot like the United States of America.
Sounds a lot like what?
Sounds a lot like the United States of America.
Well, ideally.
Yeah.
That was our goal, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, but temperance is the ability to deny yourself something that's immediately pleasurable for the sake of future gain. Prudence is the ability to know how to react in a particular situation in a way that will either defuse or accelerate it. And that's what prudence is, knowing which is which. Courage and justice are the ability to make sure that we are exercising power in a way that benefits those who are around us, and particularly those who are weaker. These are the four cardinal virtues of classical education. And classical education should be focused around these traditional definitions.
A classical approach to education teaches you how to think. It forms you into a more virtuous person, and it makes you more you. I know that sounds modern, but those are some of the goals of one of the most ancient methodologies in education. Classical education doesn't produce one kind of student. It produces a student who can make sense of himself or herself, as well as their relation to the world. It produces a person who can ask questions that lead to greater understanding. It leads to a Christian who can appreciate the beauty of the world, gain insight from the great Christian and non-Christian thinkers in the world, and contribute to society in meaningful ways. Classical education doesn't stamp you and leave a certain impression. It gives you the tools so you can leave a certain impression on the world. With this in mind, I ended the conversation with Dr. Bauer by asking for her final thoughts, and this is what she said.
I would say that I find the pairing of Christian with any curricula description to be very frustrating. Any curricula can be Christian if it's taught by a Christian.
I mean, that's
all there is to it.
Yeah.
Having some sort of artificial means of assuring yourself that your curricula is Christian only leads to legalism, oppression, and frustration. And it is particularly exasperating to me that Christian gets paired with classical in a way that is, I find, artificial and quite manipulative. It's a little bit like saying, okay, we're going to look at all this stuff from the past, but nothing disturbing, nothing that's going to upset you, nothing that's going to challenge your view of the world. Certainly nothing with weird sex in it. That is certainly not going to be part of our classical curriculum. Right. It's as if we can make education safe. And look, I've had young children. Now I have my kids are all now grown. Particularly for young children, of course, there are ways in which you have to keep them safe and not expose them to things that they're not ready for. But the entire process of education is one of letting go of safety a little bit at a time and watching kids step out into the bigger world and grapple with ideas that you might find really disturbing. You know, I always say, see, my kids are now in their late 20s and early 30s. And I have said to my friends, although not very often publicly, I really feel like I'd like to tell parents of young children that they're doing the easy part now, but I don't think that would be helpful. I had no idea that parenting young adults, you know, and this is sort of the end of my homeschool journey, was going to be this massive project of letting them go and watching them walk into things where I'm thinking, no, 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 I don't believe that. Well, that's not the point. The point of education is to equip them and then let them walk into it and trust that they are ready. So
now for a parent who had her kids in one of these classical Christian schools, what did she do when she came to the realization that Dr. Bauer described? Here's Jill to explain.
Yeah, some things happened that made me recognize that even though I think Tristan, my youngest, could have graduated from the Oaks, and it wouldn't be the best in his ability, like, but it was thankfully that Aiden was like, I can't do this. They are not it. What they are teaching is not critical thinking, and he is a very good critical thinker. So, we just decided to pull them both, you know, at the same time, but. Yeah, that was really difficult because afterwards, you know, you kind of are just off everyone's radar. I mean, again, they're so busy doing homework. They're so busy doing sports. They're so busy that, you know, you just, and you don't have things in common anymore with them. And so, but Aiden and Tristan have a best friend that they, you know, still thick as thieves. And, you know, and so that was a really, you know, great part of that. But, So Tristan, initially, because he was second semester, eighth grade, okay? And I didn't want to put him in public school at that point. And so I homeschooled him just to kind of like not have too many transitions. Mm-hmm. But that was hard putting him into high school because he didn't know anyone, right? He'd been in this small school and he was more social. He hadn't made a lot of really close friends, so it wasn't like, oh, I wish I could stay at the Oaks. But he also just had bought into, they said that government schools are bad, you mm-hmm. know, and so he would really, you know, kind of struggle with that. And then COVID happened, you know, and so, but we did have both the boys go into therapy and with more experience, like Tristan, he took a psychology class in through a Running Start program. So he graduated with a diploma and then he graduated with an AA, which was super cost effective. And you know, and in, so having more life experience, but also having that philosophy class, he started to recognize just how isolating and how small-minded, you know, I'll use that because I just really feel like they had such a, only one way mm-hmm. to look at it. Truth is only, you know, this
black
way.
And white. Yeah.
I think, yeah. So, but he's, so I think he's really, he's just come to a different place. And I am going to state this. I got permission from my sons and their friend to talk about their experience. I got consent. Mm-hmm. I really felt it was important. You know, we made a lot of decisions where, you know, and as a parent, you do that. You know, in the best efforts to do what's right for them. But I really felt like it was important to get consent to talk about this because for a while it consumed me so much, and it wasn't healthy in the sense that, you know, I just wanted so much for someone to understand my experience, and you don't understand it. I don't even think I would listen to me. At that point, because I was so involved and I felt so, I don't know, it wasn't like they were flattering me, but I felt useful and I felt like, you know, that I believe their mission so much and I wanted, you know, this to be good. And I think that their intentions are good, but the best intentions can harm. And there was harm. There was absolutely harm, and there continues to be harm. And, you know, some people's temperaments are such that, you know, it doesn't bother them, so that they can, you know, shut that off. But for other people, you know, it really, you know, sticks, you know, in them. And that's hard because it feels like there's just such that bar moves as for whoever is in power, you know. They expect so much from you, but they don't have to, you know, stay to that standard, and they can, you know, they can move it whenever they want.
Yeah.
And with that, before I conclude, I'll leave you with Jill's warning for those looking to send their kids to one of these kinds of schools. I don't say this to blacklist every classical Christian school, but to ask critical questions of them and consider what kind of education you want your kids to have. Do you want them to think well? Originally, somebody who's at Oaks, somebody who's at Logo, somebody who's at one of these schools, and it is fear-based, and maybe they're not seeing it on the front end, but they start to see it like you did.
So
we talked about for those who are looking at it, but now what would you tell those who are in it? Because our assumption is they're going to be listening to this and they're questioning and they're wondering, am I in this? Or maybe they've been thinking this for a while. And they hear what you're saying and they say, yeah, actually that is what I'm going through. What would you tell them?
Not to be afraid to make a change. Do not let fear, your fear of the unknown and stop you. Like, do your research. We went and met with the counselor at our local high school, and immediately we just felt this. I had no idea that, you know, that the counselors kind of can help you figure out who are the best teachers, you know, you do really well in, and that they had some influence on, like, helping you to meet some people, you know, and, you know, that the counselors at the high schools really want you to be mentally healthy. They want you to walk across with your diploma and feel like, you know, you tried on a lot of different varieties of yourself, and you know a little bit more about, you know, who you are or what you want to become, or, you know, just be curious. Like, our kids need to be curious. They should not be afraid. And you can just be as involved as you are at the Oaks. I mean, the great thing about, you know, the public school is that the grades are now online. So mm-hmm. You can check up on your kid. You can call the advisor. You can email their teachers. There's lots of ways that you can be involved too and know what's going on. But you may have to realize that there are some mental health issues that are deep-seated that a therapist can help you, you know, and your child work through, because those messages can really be scary, cause more anxiety and more depression. And if you're recognizing that there are, you know, maybe some sleep issues, or there's lots of stomach issues, or there's migraines going on, or, you know, they don't want to go to school, or you're just seeing kind of even a change in their temperament. Like, I saw Tristan, who was our risk taker, and he just was very much like, you know, happy. And, you know, once he started in seventh grade, he became a lot more like cautious and looking for, you know, what signals from his teachers on what he should say and how he should say and what he should do. And, you know, so, yeah, you still have to be an involved parent. Absolutely. Stay involved and, you know, get your kids to read tons of stuff and talk. You know, I mean, it was really hard to get Aiden to talk about anything that he was doing at the Oaks. And then when he went to public school, like, there was some really amazing stories. Like, he had a heart for people. Tristan especially had a heart for people. He met people that were so different from him, and it just opened his eyes. And so one of the things that we're doing now as a family is we are part of Safe Families, and that is a volunteer organization that's through a lot of different churches. But for single parents, specifically moms, because like 95% of the time, and they just need respite. And, you know, so we come alongside the moms and the kids, and, you know, we have them spend the night, or we take them out for activities. And we're just like doing things that I think, you know, Jesus would really want us to do. We didn't have time for that. We were so busy with, you know, making sure all the details and that the parents had signed the lesson plans, or, you know, their homework times and all of, you know, that the socks were.
And it was insular too. So it was not like you went out of your community all too often. It's like, this is your people. Don't go outside of your people.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it just gives you a view of, you know, of the world and compassion, you know, and to be able to make a difference. Like, they weren't making a difference with all of the classical education knowledge that they had. They didn't know how to apply it, or they couldn't apply it, or, you know, they were just so fearful. And it's hard work, you know, but, you know, the world is in a different place with, you know, social media and all of the technology and everything that's going on. And so I really don't know that the classical or that the Oaks, you know, and what their version of, you know, their education is really going to be as beneficial as they like to think. But you know what? Everyone is different. Mm-hmm. And if you, you know, love the classics and you have, you know, that in you that you want to go to a college, you know, and you're going to be very much, you know, cognitively challenged in those things, that, you know, yeah, but know that there's a high indoctrination, and maybe that's not, you know, what you think you're paying for, but you're getting a lot.
Because education is so important, we must think about how we train our kids, what we train them with, and what we train them for. The Christian faith has non-negotiables: the trustworthiness of Scripture, the triunity of the Godhead, the virgin birth, and the historical life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, among many other things. Those are rigid. Those are revealed. Those are sacred. Where we run into problems is we bleed the sacred into the secular, and Christians gag at the word secular. That's lesser than, less worthy of, not worth thinking about. So then I ask, what is worth thinking about? And the answer, what is true, what is good, and what is beautiful, the gospel of Jesus Christ, that's worth thinking about. I have no qualms with that. It's assuming everything else is less important, less worthy of our intellectual pursuit. Assuming that education has a single aim, to make you more Christian. Because that more holds a lot of weight. It typically doesn't stop at the non-negotiables, or at least expands them. It looks at the world, the whole world that God made, and sees things more and less worthy of learning, of appreciating. It forces a lens to look at all things, a hall monitor that allows some things, not others, where critical thinking is sacrificed on the altar of right thinking. That there's one way a Christian thinks, and education exists towards that end. But here's the thing, as Dr. Bauer stated, not one of our Christian forefathers and mothers thought that way. They weren't even trained that way. You learn, you question, you investigate, you critique. Taking every thought captive is then less an iron grip on worldly thoughts, but a critical analysis of them. Where education serves to expand the mind, not in order to question your faith, but to season it. God isn't afraid of hard questions. He isn't worried about a critical thinker. He's not nervous when you open up a secular science textbook. He can handle it. Education forms you. It doesn't indoctrinate you. I want to thank both Dr. Susan Wise Bauer and Jill Wright for their time, expertise, and experience. My hope is this does for you, the listener, the same thing we hope classical education does for kids. It taught you how to think about education rather than what to think about it. In our next episode, we move from the schooling system to the denomination that Doug Wilson founded, the CREC. My guess is by now you might have heard about it. It's been in the news because of everything they stand against. That's next week, episode 9, The Anti-Denomination. See you then. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.